Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode number 50 of the Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and we made it to episode 50. It's pretty cool. I never thought this podcast would last till episode number 5, let alone number 50. So I am very happy to be here with you. And with us today is two men, Byron and Daryl Pace from Scotland. And I would imagine that if you've never been to Scotland, or if you're not aware of their hunting culture, these are the two best guys to be talking to get the perspective from that side of the world. And Byron and Daryl are also prolific creators of media. They have a podcast. They're wonderful photographers. And they are also filmmakers. They make me feel a little bit lazy by seeing and watching and learning about what they do. But also, they've lived amazing lives for their young years. And, well, we wanted to get into a lot of the land use and wildlife management in Scotland, but we didn't get there because their life stories are so damn interesting. So please enjoy, straight from the Meat Eater offices of Montana, Byron and Daryl Pace, the Pace brothers, on episode number 50.
I'm warming up now.
Yeah. You're getting used to it after. It says, what, it's been a week?
It is, but we left Scotland, it was pretty cold.
Yeah.
Although not minus 20
Celsius.
Which is what it was in Yellowstone when we visited the first day.
Yeah.
No, it's just a couple of degrees under and a wee bit of snow. It's all gone now.
You enjoying Montana?
No, it's terrible.
It's
the views are terrible.
Yeah, it makes you not want to come back. Nah, it's amazing here. Absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
It's actually screwed me up, if I'm honest, because I've spent so much of my life always looking for the backup to Scotland, where we live, where we're from. And despite all the awesome places I've been around the world, I wouldn't make that trade. And now I've been here a week and I'm like, oh dear.
Oh, I found a place.
Now I found a place.
I'm very much into plan B. I have like this thing where in case I lose my job and my wife and son decide they don't want me around anymore, you got to have like a, you know, pull the ripcord. So for me, it's New Zealand. It used to be Alaska until I went to New Zealand. I was like, whoa, I could live here. So that's my plan B. So maybe this could be your plan B in case everything doesn't work out.
Maybe plan A.
If you guys let us in.
Yeah, well, we would let you in.
Okay.
Yeah,
we're nice.
At least a temporary visa.
We'd have to ask Ben nicely for a temporary job.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell around here, we have plenty of seats and people to fill them.
You know, I was tempted when I was looking through your store, the Meat Eater story the other day, and I saw a couple of jobs up for grabs and thought,
well, let's do an interview now.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
We're recording.
Tell me about your skills. No, here at the Meat Eater, we'll ask you, like, what if you were a bird, what type of bird would you be? That's how our interviews begin.
Well, after seeing a bald eagle for the first time the other day, I think I want to be that.
That's a bad motherfucker.
The first time I'd seen one.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was right outside Tyler's house.
I mean, it didn't, you know, I don't know that I saw a bald eagle until I was in my teenage years because I lived on the East Coast and then very rare there.
Not populated though.
Not populated. There are some around. You'd see them, you know, rarely. But then now I live over here on the Gallatin River and they fly across my backyard every morning.
It's pretty special.
It's a pretty special thing.
They must be, I mean, it was above my head, so it's difficult to judge the scale of something when it's just in the sky.
Yeah.
But sea eagles are the biggest thing we have in Scotland, but golden eagles being more common, but they were a lot bigger than a golden eagle.
Yeah, yeah. They're a big raptor. And you know, for us, they have, you know, when you go like Prince of Wales Island, say, coastal Alaska, and they're like buzzards. I mean, they're everywhere, and every pile of trash has a bald eagle on it. Every dead carcass has 10 bald eagles on it. You know, every dead seal that's washed up on the shore has 10 bald eagles. So I imagine if you lived in that place, your perspective might be a little bit different. But here, man, to see a bald eagle, I mean, we were sitting in the airport, and I look out, and there's like a bald eagle flying with a backdrop of the Bridger Mountains, and I'm like, oh, man. In my mind, I was like, America.
Yeah, that's the American dream, right?
Yeah,
there.
That's it right there. Yeah. That's like if I was a pilgrim coming out west and I stopped and saw that, I'd be like, I'll live here. I will homestead here. All right, we're going to talk a lot about where you came from, but first, I want to talk about your time in Montana. You got to give me, we got bison hunts. You guys have met and podcasted with some interesting individuals and plan to do more. So yeah, you got to tell us all about it.
We've got a busy day ahead today.
Yeah.
We're seeing your buddy Brad.
Yeah.
Over at Sitka later, which is going to be pretty cool. And the first thing that happened when we came to Montana was we went to Yellowstone.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't get much better than that. I think that's a pretty good introduction.
Yeah. What did, you know, being from Scotland and coming here, obviously that's a legendary place. I mean, it's a place of held in high regard in our country. I mean, does it hold up to the legend in your mind?
Yeah, it does. You know, everyone at home knows Yellowstone.
I think
pretty much everyone in the world.
I think everybody does.
Knows Yellowstone. It's probably, I dare say, it's probably the most well-known national park in the world.
Wow.
Other day in the UK, like, you'd be lucky if three or four National Geographics a year don't have something to do with Yellowstone in the UK. So, yeah. I mean, it's widely known.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, it is. I went there for the first time 2 years ago, and it was amazing. I mean, there's not just the wildlife. Did you guys go to the paint pots and go to the...
Well, a lot of the roads are closed.
There
was only sort of the main drags. There was only one of the thermal areas that you could get to. So we were told it wasn't the most vivid, but it was still cool to see.
Yeah.
But it was the bison that kind of, I think, blew us away. It's this icon of North America, and it's this icon of conservation. And I kind of expected to go in there and see them, but they might be over there when we might have to, you know, be looking with the binos for an hour. And we were in there for all of about 30 seconds. I was like, there's a bison.
This
and it was like,
one.
Yeah. And then Tyler, who was driving us around and chauffeuring us, was like, no, it's okay, you're going to see loads. And sure enough, we went around the next bend, there was 30, and then there was 50. And then we went down onto this plain where we were looking for one of the wolf packs, and there was maybe 200 or 300 bison down there. And it was like, it kind of made me feel like the early pioneers.
Yeah.
They must have felt just like popping over the horizon and just seeing this vastness, this wilderness, and all these animals everywhere.
Yeah. And I think going in the wintertime, I did this winter for the first time, and going in the summertime is a completely different experience. I mean, in the summertime, you're just a traffic jams around the buffalo, you know, and to go there and just, like you said, to see it, you know, it's not untouched, but to see it rather unbothered. You know,
we were pretty lucky. There wasn't that many people on the road.
They were saying that it was very quiet, which I'm glad. Glad you get to experience
selfishly,
it without,
without
a, you know, a carload of people behind you.
And that's, you know, that is the very, you go in July and you will have that. So it is. We've talked about it on this podcast before. I always felt conflicted about that because I think it's this great, as you said, this great representation of what our Western United States has to offer, and really this continent has to offer. But sometimes you go there and you feel like, man, I wish we would have put a thumb on this some years ago. But we talked about in past in some other conversations, it being just a representative for wildlife, you know, it being a place that everyone can go to see what it's like in wild places without having to interact. Because not everybody will go and interact in the way that we
do. It's important, that because it gives people a reason to be interested when they can see it in a tangible form. But we have the same problem in Scotland in certain locations, not so much with wildlife, but with landscape, and like the Isle of Skye, which is the most awesome place.
Yeah.
And yet, through the summer months, we just don't go there anymore because there's just so many tourists.
Yeah.
And it's
which is ironic because we're obviously a tourist here, so we're complaining about tourists.
And it's a conflict, isn't it?
Yes,
because
it is.
I don't want to be selfish and say, well, don't go there, because I don't want you, because you're a pain in the ass, you're blocking all the roads, and there's 200 cars parked to go and, you know, look at a particular rock formation, because I want to see it. So why should I not share it with everyone else? But
there's a difference here, though. They're paying to go in.
They are paying, and they don't pay.
In Scotland, they don't.
They don't pay.
And so it is actually having detrimental impacts to the local people and the environment there.
Also, the scale's much bigger. Yellowstone, I mean, even if you do have loads and loads of people disturbing wildlife on roads and potentially walking on trails and that, it's so big that wildlife can move off into its own area and not be disturbed.
Yeah. Yes.
And we were doing the maths of scale of Yellowstone, and it's just, compared to what we have at home, it's colossal.
Yeah, 3,500 square miles.
Yeah, it's just
unbelievable.
Nuts. We think our national parks are big.
Yeah.
It's just like a drop in the ocean.
Yeah. No, I think it's I've come to appreciate the fact that it for what it represents. It represents a chance for people to go and see wildlife and be inspired to go and learn more. But sometimes when you go there and there's a traffic jam for an hour and a half to see Old Faithful, you think, damn, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is, what are we really doing this the right way? But I feel like there's so much positive that comes from it. You can't, you know, it's hard to really focus on the negative. It's such a beautiful place.
Yeah, it is. It blew us away for sure.
Good. Good. And I'm glad you got to, like I said, got to go there in the winter and experience it that way. There's a calmness there in the winter that there certainly isn't. And
we were learning something interesting yesterday, because, you know, we saw so many bison, and we saw two elk fighting. We were telling you about this the other day, fighting in the petrol station. We put up a picture of it. And we saw a handful of female elk. But we were speaking to someone yesterday, and they were telling us how the elk population inside Yellowstone has declined so much over the last 20 years, largely due to the wolf predation, which I hadn't appreciated at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it becomes, I think test case is probably the wrong word, but that's what it becomes. I mean, it's an untouched landscape where human interaction is not allowed.
Because there's no management inside Yellowstone at all.
No. There's, you know, problem animals are killed, there's interactions with humans, but there's no hunting-based management within Yellowstone at all. And, you know, people love to hunt the edges.
Yep.
Yeah.
We had a buddy out there doing that just the other day for bison. So it is this, like, you know, often anti-hunters or vegans would say, like, wouldn't we just, why do we have to prey upon animals now? You know, we can just go to the store and eat meat, and let's allow the natural predator prey balance to, you know, let's reintroduce grizzly bears, reintroduce wolves into their native range, and just let it go. And I would say Yellowstone is a good example of what can happen and what likely will.
I think people don't appreciate this, quite the scale of landscape that you need for wildlife to truly balance itself. Yeah. As we've said, Yellowstone is colossal. But in the grand scheme of these massive migrations that historically used to happen and the interactions of wildlife across the, you know, all of North America, which is a vast place, it's still relatively small.
Yes.
I mean, everything is relative. It is small in relation to North America, but it's large in relation to a landmass in Scotland.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's very difficult for us to get our heads around actually what scale you need for wildlife to look after itself.
So what else do you guys do in Montana? Is there anything that sticks out beyond the grandness of Yellowstone?
Well, I think Daryl's probably, I mean, we've been meeting people. It's been, you know, we're catching up with you and a whole heap of other people that we've been doing some podcasts with.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we've been staying with Tyler Sharp, editor of Modern Huntsman. And we did some stuff on Volume 2, and we're going to be doing some bits and pieces and working on Volume 3 as well. So that's been part of the reason for being here. But I think Daryl probably managed to steal the highlight of sort of activities, because he was photographing a bison hunt. Not yesterday, the day before.
Yeah, like two days ago.
Mm. Yeah.
It was yeah, it was pretty damn amazing. Because especially when you're told, oh, we're going to go and do a bison hunt, and then you find out it's on horseback as well.
And, it was last minute. We did not come here knowing that this was going to happen.
That's awesome.
It got hooked up for us while we were here.
Literally like 24 hours before, it was like, yes or no, like you're going.
And you can't say no to that. Yeah,
so I went. And being on a horse riding up into the mountains is kind of just been a dream of mine forever. And this is what I was trying to tell the people I was with. I was like, I don't think you appreciate how special this is, because they do it all the time.
Yeah.
This, for them, this is a yearly thing, taking horses up into the, you know, those mountains. And it was annoying because I was taking pictures. I couldn't actually.
You know, it's difficult to appreciate when you're taking pictures. Like, yes. when you're doing a job.
But also it was the added challenge of taking pictures on horseback. So that was interesting. But we rode higher and higher, and you know, wooded area, and went up this track, and it was amazing. Unfortunately we didn't see anything at all.
Well, you saw pronghorns, didn't you? You didn't see anybody.
Yeah, but that was right at the bottom, basically, by the truck when we started. So,
it's funny the perspective there, because you know, from the hunter's perspective, who's from this area and does that every year, it's like, wow, this is an unsuccessful day. But to you, it's like, this is a day I'll remember for a long time.
Like, yeah, I said this to him. I was like, you do not. I appreciate this so much that I got to go along. And you know, we were speaking to people back home. People back home literally save up for potentially their whole life to do what I just did.
Yeah.
So
it's so easy to forget the importance of the things that are on your doorstep. And the same is true for us at home. You know, we live just below the Highland Fault in Scotland. So when we look out from our office, the mountains start, that's the Highland Faults of historic Scotland right there.
We've got like four castles like around where we live.
And you know, of course we don't think about
that. And you guys live in a castle, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. Oh. Everyone in Scotland
lives in a castle. That's what I'm telling everybody. Right? My friends are coming over, they live in a castle.
But you know, we don't think about it every day. And sometimes I do have to just sit there normally with a brandy in hand or something.
Yes.
Something well like that. Well, when it's a contemplation juice.
Yes.
And look at the mountains and just take a deep breath. Like, this is where I live. And the same is true for, you know, the folks who live here and get to experience what is really quite a unique thing. Horseback into the mountains of Montana.
Yeah. Everywhere I go, I remember prior to moving to Montana, when I felt like I lived in a less impressive environment, when I always come to here, one of the first questions I would ask the guide or whoever was hosting me or whomever I was with that lived in that place is like, does this ever get old? Do you ever wake up and just like breeze by the mountain and just forget what you're looking at? Like, forget that you're on the doorstep of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem that holds, you know, America's wildlife treasures. And I've been here for about 3 months, so hasn't hit me yet I'm here. You know, it's like the reverse. I haven't yet got to appreciate it because it's hit me that I live here and intend to live here for a long time. So, I mean, it's the opposite, but you're right. I mean, I'm sure people that live there all their life, there's days they wake up and they just breeze through life and they forget.
You get busy, you know.
Yeah.
You get busy with life.
Just human
surviving,
nature.
Surviving.
Yeah. I'm just glad I spent quite a few years learning to ride horses back home. It's quite different here, different saddles and a different environment. You know, the most we ever did was kind of trails and across fields, kind of hacking across farmers' fields and things like that, but not into the mountains as such, because we don't have this kind of wooded alpine steep areas that you can just ride a horse into. It doesn't exist back home. So that was pretty cool. My horse was called Shrek.
Was he green?
Did he talk?
I appreciate that he was pretty chilled, because I was clicking the camera, obviously, above his head. And the guy that owned the horse was like, yeah, he might be a bit edgy with that, because that's making the same noise as the electric fence in his paddock. So I'm clicking right above his head. And he was a bit edgy for the first 10 minutes, and then he kind of just, oh, this
like,
is...
You're right.
Yeah, you're
easy,
right.
Boy.
Yeah.
Easy, boy. Yeah. Easy. Now, I mean, it's good to hear that you have that perspective and coming all the way across the world like you did to have that experience. I appreciate that, too. For my money, I'll do my best not to lose perspective on this place and you know what it is, and I think that's that's why people here want to fight for it so much.
Yeah.
You know, fight for access to it, fight for its health and its, you know, the health of these ecosystems because it is such a prize.
Yeah. You know?
And for me, Montana was one of these locations that was always on the bucket list for visiting. Mm. And it's going to be a little bit cheesy, but that started with A River Runs Through It.
Yeah.
That incredible. That's all right. I mean, even today, I mean, it is a piece of cinema for sure. It's a beautiful film.
Hired from the local library on tape.
Yeah. Exactly. On VHS. And just seeing that, I mean, it was the mountains, it was the river, it was the fish. It was obviously of a different period. And I am probably somewhat guilty of hankering for periods of the past.
Yeah.
True of North America. And that's probably one of the reasons I have spent so much time in Africa. But because of that, it was what was the catalyst for my intrigue of North America.
Yeah.
And understanding what happened here historically. And of course, you guys have a fascinating story.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, a fascinating wildlife story. But I think, you know, I was doing this earlier. I just thought, what if I Google hunting in Scotland, what's going to come up? Nothing comes up. There's
really
no good information, at least in my searching. Like, there's no, here is the preeminent source to learn about hunting in Scotland or you know, hunting in the United Kingdom over and above that.
That's interesting.
It's interesting you say, because funny enough, I was just thinking the other day, because I write a back page of a hunting magazine at home, and when I took it over, it was always on historical figures in hunting. And when I took it over, I said, look, I'm not just going to make it about historical figures, but I'm going to make it about historical and current figures, and it's going to be people who have not only been important for hunting, but also important for conservation, even if they had nothing to do with hunting. So I think that's important. Many of them did, especially the historical figures. And it's very, very easy to find awesome examples in the rest of the world. I mean, North America is full of them.
Yes.
There's some great examples in Africa and India and the rest of the world. And we do have them in the UK, but they're not spoken about.
Yeah.
They're names that if you were to mention them, most people wouldn't know
who they are. Yeah.
And that's kind of sad. And I realized this week in the long journeys we've been driving around that I need to try and readdress that a little bit. And I have been putting them on the back page, but it needs to be more than that. It's a magazine that goes in the bin every month.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've learned a lot about it from you guys specifically, but without you guys, I probably would still think it's, you know, dudes in tweed, you know, asking the gamekeeper if they can go out and kill a red deer. But so talk about where you come from and it's kind of your upbringing and a little bit of, you know, kind of take us over to Scotland and give us a little bit of an insight into your lives growing up.
Do you want to start, Dale?
Yeah, I can start.
Start, Mr. Navy.
Yeah, so I was born in the Highlands, so in Inverness, on the banks of Loch Ness, looking at a monster. I was born in Inverness. I don't really remember my time up there too much because I was too young.
You were like 1 year old.
Yeah, but we had a boat on Loch Ness. And then we moved, where did we go to after that? It was near Aberdeen.
Where we live now.
Yeah.
It was straight, for you, it was straight from Inverness to there.
Basically from there, we, ever since we were, I don't know, we could walk. My dad took us out hunting, rabbit hunting, bit of pigeon shooting,
fishing,
and that was just our life. We used to do a lot of like stock ponds because when you're small, you wanna. It's better to catch a child's attention if they're guaranteed.
I used to do that. Yeah, my dad just drop your line in this hole and you'll pull out a sunfish every time.
It's more exciting.
Yes.
And then you can move on to the days of no catching, not catching any fish, which is quite common.
Yes.
Back home. But in the early days, I kind of hunting for us was a little bit more of a necessity than for fun or anything, because both our parents are from Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, and they basically came to the UK due to
after the
Bush War, and they saw that things were going to go downhill. And well, you can see the state of Zimbabwe now.
Yes.
It hasn't really changed since then. If not, it's worse than ever. And they came to the UK, and my dad will tell you, with two suitcases and £400, which is probably true. And they were, my dad was shooting rabbits for food.
Yeah. He also told us about digging coal out from an old coal bunker.
And that's true.
For heat. Because they'd rented this shitty little cottage on a farm somewhere outside Aberdeen. Because he didn't want to live in the city.
Yeah.
he wanted to live in the countryside, but obviously you can't afford to.
Can't afford
it. Yeah, so there was like a damp. He did point it out to us once, but I can't remember. Yeah. It's just this damp little one-bed cottage with nothing to stay warm. So.
But yeah, it was through a complete necessity of extra food. Meat's expensive. So shooting rabbits, pigeons, just whatever he could get his hands on. He was working behind a bar
yeah.
There, so you know, not a huge amount of money to support a family of four.
Yeah.
And then as life went on, he got a different job and we moved, and the hunting aspect just stayed with us our entire lives. A lot more fishing.
Earlier on,
a lot more fishing because where we live now, where our office is, there's a river that just goes straight past it. So that's kind of, after school, we could go take our rods and just fish.
Like a 10-minute walk.
Yeah, a 10-minute walk. It was kind of like a little section of paradise.
And it was all... we can talk about this later, but it was most of the rivers and the land's private, and this was owned by the local farmer who was a friend. So we had like 4 or 5 miles of river that no one ever fished could fish all to ourselves. And we're like 10 and 12.
Did your father in Zimbabwe, did they hunt there? Or did he just pick it up, you know, like you say, out of necessity
when he came to Scotland? I mean, he hunted a lot as a kid, you know, with an air gun and you know, whatever else our grandfather would bring back from the army there. He was always bringing him back different guns and stuff to shoot. But it was different times, you know. He would give him a gun to say, you know, here, son, I've taken this for the weekend for you to shoot, but, you know, here's 6 bullets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like we're spoiled now.
Oh yeah.
Or it was he had an air gun that an uncle had bought him, if I'm remembering the story correctly, and they didn't have a huge amount of money either. So it wasn't, you know, when I bought my first air gun, I bought 5,000 pellets.
Yeah.
Just so that once I found the ones I liked, because I didn't want to run out.
Wow.
He'd be given a little box of 25. And that was it. And then he'd have to go and ask our grand...
Make you a better shot that way.
Yeah, it does. So he did a lot of that, but not... You would think growing up in Africa that there would be lots of big stories of big game. But there wasn't for him. But one generation back, there was.
There was also a bush war going on.
Yeah.
So
well, he was doing... You know, they were fighting people when they should have been having fun.
Yeah.
You know, in the teenage years,
18,
early 20s.
It was like national service, so... Yeah, you don't want to venture too far into the bush because, you know, there's people.
it's kind of stolen from them. But
yeah, well, and it sounds to me like, despite, you know, I would say relative, you know, poverty when you guys were growing up, you found that it seems like you had a happy childhood.
We had a great. I mean, we wanted for nothing. We can't complain.
Zero complaint.
By the time we were, you know, of any age.
Yeah.
Dad had forged on.
Yeah,
you know, mom and dad had forged on. He had good jobs, worked in the oil, and then
that was from working in the bar. Someone behind the bar was like, "You shouldn't be behind the bar. I'm going to give you a job on oil." And he got
a
job.
Awesome.
Yeah, he got a job on oil, and then was made redundant very quickly afterwards.
A few years. 1987, the year I was born, was one of the big oil slumps, globally oil slump, which I then paralleled. In 2000 and
both of us
2015 or whatever, when this next global oil slump came, because I was working in oil at the time. So funny parallel there.
Real funny parallel.
But to continue with my story, I guess. So growing up, going through high school, I didn't really do a huge amount of hunting or anything through high school. Byron did a lot more than I did. I would go out pheasant shooting and pigeon shooting. I did that quite a bit, but nothing too serious.
I was too busy chasing girls.
Yeah.
Too busy chasing girls.
Well, my brother still to this day doesn't really hunt at all, or doesn't hunt at all. And I attributed to his partying.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
I was like, hey,
partying with his buddies and chasing girls.
Saturday morning, would you like to get up early at about 4 a.m. and drive to the hunting spot and spend all day walking around the woods, or would you like to stay up all night and go to sleep at 4 a.m.?
See, what he hasn't told you is that his incentive for riding horses was also motivated by that.
It was.
Where do you want to place it dominated by females?
It was
go ride a riding club. Yes.
I was like the
lady that can ride a horse. I found is a good match.
I was the only dude, and there was about 15 girls. So I mean, it was a no brainer.
You're a smart man.
Exactly.
To be admired. Was there a hunting culture growing up for you? I mean, because was it as prevalent as you've seen here in the States?
No, it's definitely not as prevalent. And the thing for us was, although, like Daryl said, Dad was, you know, showing us the ropes as best as he knew. It was still a new country for him. So the equivalent of my dad, if he had grown up in Scotland, you know, I would have known all the plants, all, you know, all the flora, all the fauna, and all the intricacies of the wildlife and management there, you know, by the age of like 12. But he couldn't tell us that because he didn't know.
And he didn't know anyone either. So we had, you know, at the beginning, almost zero access to, for shooting, I'm talking about, zero access to going shooting anywhere. Because you, especially where we live, if you want to shoot easily accessible land, then you've got to know a farmer on the low ground.
Yeah.
So that's what we ended up doing. Well, I mean,
we've lived there our whole life now, and now we have access to all of it around our little kingdom of our office.
Around the castle.
Around the castle.
I knew it.
But what was it?
Well, Ben was asking about the culture, but we can expand on that, but there is a good culture of hunting, and obviously an incredible historic story of hunting in the UK and in Scotland in particular, but it's not as sort of publicly in your face as it is in here. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's very obvious for me driving around here that person probably hunts. you see the way people are dressed and the way people act, and the Rocky Mountain Foundation plates.
Especially around this
point. We're in the mecca of it, aren't we?
Yeah, you're in the core of it here for sure.
So we had to, you know, gun safety, fishing. We were given the elements to take it on if we wanted, but a lot of what we did after was, you know, we were teaching ourselves and then eventually teaching Dad.
because he's busy working, and he was away grafting
and working.
So. Well, until the age of what, 12, 13 years old,
working back in Africa.
He was still working in Africa.
Yeah, it's very similar to a lot of, you know, the patrilineal, the way that it happens here. Like for me, I grew up with my dad. My dad had this amazing ability to, you know, when I was a kid, he could name every tree, name every bird, you know, name pretty much everything, and, you know, for me, and teach me that. But at the same time, he came up and his father didn't hunt. He came to hunting on his own. And again, he didn't have this, like, this is the way we do it. This is how we hunt. It's just, hunting was a thing we did. It wasn't, it wasn't so structured. It was like, we can buy a license, we'll go out and shoot this deer, we'll eat this deer. And we didn't talk much more about it than that. I mean, it was kind of, that's what we never talked about the philosophies of it or our wild places or conservation. We never did that because it was just part of our lives, part of our lifestyle. Never to be questioned, never to be, you know, really thought through on a deeper level. And that's not to say anything bad about my dad, but that's just how it was then. It was just a more accepted practice, I feel like. At least where I grew up.
Yeah.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate Batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
Then from, well, after I finished chasing girls, riding horses.
That's also very natural for the American hunter to, like, start hunting around 12, hunt till 18, take it a little break during college, chase girls, drink beer, and then come back to it in the early 20s.
We had an experience try dive. So this is kind of where my career started at the age of about 16. And it was basically go to a swimming pool, try scuba diving.
In Aberdeen, yeah.
And I was like, this is awesome. Being able to breathe underwater is like...
I can fly.
It blew my mind. So I decided there and then that's what I want to do for a living. Yeah. That's what I want to do. And I was like, how do I achieve this? So I was in my last year of high school and I said to them, I want to be a diver. They didn't really know what to do with me because that's an insane career choice as far as they were concerned. And I managed to arrange to work at a dive shop in Aberdeen on Fridays. And they basically said, yeah, you can take the Friday off school and you can basically work experience.
This is an hour from where we live, so it's not exactly close. Yeah.
It's a bit of a commute.
And my neighbor worked in Aberdeen as a recruiter for the military. Mm. And he was like, hey, I'll give you a lift to the dive shop every day because he kind of went past it. And, you know, the weeks go by. And he starts speaking. He's like, you know, the Navy has divers, right? And I was like, no, I didn't know that. And he's like, yeah. Let's, if you want some more information, then
I come along to the office.
That's how they do it.
Come along to the office. And they gave me this leaflet. And it basically was just like 3 pages of pictures of like divers doing underwater knife fighting, bomb disposal.
All the cool shit.
Hawaii on a beach with 10 women. And
you come up, you're like, I defused the bomb, ladies.
Like my tie, Poseidon's please. Trident. Yeah. And I was like, that's the coolest thing ever. I want to do that. And so I signed up, did all my tests, and... What they didn't tell me originally, they were like, there's basically a 2% chance of you doing this. That's the success rate from the moment that you walk through the careers office to the moment that you finish your dive training. There is a 2% chance that you'll make it to the end.
Oh, wow.
Just due to a number of factors. One, some people just don't like the diving because it's mainly dark. Secondly, the physical aspect. I used to be a lot fitter than I was now. And thirdly, the mental aspect, which is probably the most important. So I joined up basically when I turned 18, because you had to be 18 to join that unit. And I went through training. And then I don't think I quite appreciated how much bomb disposal was involved in because I was a mine clearance diver.
Yeah, you're a mine
clearance diver. It was in the title, but I didn't quite appreciate how much we were going to be doing. Which was really cool because I do like blowing things up.
Yes.
Who doesn't
like this? It is an interesting, if somebody says you're going to dive and you're going to defuse, you're going to take care of these bombs, I'd be like, this is pretty fucking badass, man.
Yeah, it was cool and I loved it. You know, as an 18-year-old, like that's the coolest job title on the planet.
Yeah.
And I loved it. But I mean, training was... It was bloody hard. I mean, once you go through basic training, that's basically a piece of piss. It's just toe the line, polishing, ironing, washing, marching, all that kind of shit. And a bit of like battle damage repair. And it was quite cool, actually. You do spend a bit of time in this huge, it's like part of a ship. and then they pretend it's been hit by missiles, and it starts to flood, and the whole thing is like on hydraulics and starts to rock. So it's like the ultimate simulator, and the compartment's filled to the top.
Wow!
So if you don't stop the leaks, guess what? You're underwater. So that's pretty cool in basic training. But once you finish that, you're like, right, dive training week one. Bear in mind, you've already done a selection to be on the dive course, so this is like the second selection, and it's 1 week. We started on day one with 38 people. By the end of the week, we had 10 left.
Holy.
And then when I finished, so that basically by the end of the training, it's almost a year, basically, once you've gone through it all. By the time I finished, there was 4 of us left. That was it.
And people are just dropping out because they can't hack it physically, mentally.
I would say that it's 90% a mental game. You do have to be physically fit.
Of course.
A lot of it was... Yeah, it was just it was a mental game. A lot of time by yourself. You're diving for 3-4 hours by yourself in the pitch black at a time, and just swimming. I mean, it was pointless tasks in a way, other than getting used to your dive set and that. But it was swim until you run out of air. That was it. And for hours and hours and hours. And
what's it like being down there in the dark? Like, you know, like I said, flying or, you know,
it's
suspended in some way.
Well, I was in a fortunate position where I'd actually done quite a lot of diving before I joined, which was a good and a bad thing, because it's kind of like if you're learning how to drive and then you go on to do like an advanced driving course or a police driving course, yeah, like I did, and then they look at you and go, you're shit.
We just dived. Once we passed our like civilian courses,
we bought all the gear
and then we just, the two of us just went diving on the coast.
So there's a lot of things that you got to kind of unlearn and then relearn. But diving just gives you the most amount of freedom you can think, especially if you're in nice waters. And when you're in training, the water's not particularly amazing, and at night, because you're wearing a rebreather most of the time, and you've got a head-up display. And the early dive set, which we kind of called the death set because it killed so many people, the eels used to come at night and see the green light and the red light on your head-up display, and they used to hit you straight in the face, wow, square in the face, but you didn't see them coming because it was pitch black, and that used to get the heart rate.
Yes!
The heart rate going. Once I had finally finished training, then it was into the big bad mix, and you basically got on a ship for... about three years. So I ended up doing two deployments.
Wow.
One out into the Baltic Sea, which is basically, it was basically a piss up around Europe while blowing up
hard-earned
bombs.
Tax money.
And we basically visited nearly every country in that basin. So
what years were these?
That was 2000. And so I joined in 2008, 2009. And then I think it was 2010 was my first deployment. And that was 7 months, part of a NATO task force. And yeah, so we'd basically spend like 2 weeks just looking for ordnance and then go ashore and then get drunk and run around Europe. And yeah, that was it. So, I mean,
like a proper sailor.
Oh, yeah. In my first deployment, I visited, maybe 10, 11 countries.
Wow.
In my first deployment. And that was really cool. And also, we were working with so many other nations as well. And a lot of the stuff we were looking for was stuff from World War One, World War Two. And there was some modern day stuff as well. We found a U-boat, which was pretty cool. So they used sonar to look on the seabed. And we found a U-boat, but that was at like some ridiculous depth. So we didn't get to go and dive.
I was going to say, did you dive to it?
No, we didn't. It was way too deep.
Could have been full of gold.
Potentially, but the Germans were with us.
The story was going.
No, sorry, there's no.
Then we found the gold,
and that's why we've got a castle.
As you well know, yeah. we found the gold.
We found a lot of ordnance. We actually found one. It was a German sea mine, and it was almost in the harbor entrance of Estonia, their main harbor entrance, where they have maybe 10 plus ferries a day going in and out of there, like huge passenger ferries. And this was like a 2,000 pound sea mine. It was huge.
Holy shit.
And we found it, and we were like, okay, well, we're going to get rid of it. And the Germans that were with us were like, nah, it's right. It's our mine.
It's our fault.
We did it.
We did it.
We'll fix it.
We'll deal with it. And we found it, and we didn't always used to do it. We used to send basically an ROV down to have a look at it. That didn't always happen. Most of the time it was the divers that went down and did the initial see what it is. But this time we sent the ROV and we ID'd it. And the Germans sent down their RV when it was their time to go and get rid of it. And their RV hit it and it went off. And this was from World War II. Yeah. It was like, basically the rule of thumb was, if it was German, it was very well made and it probably still functioned. Not always. I mean, I could go into the different ways of,
I'm interested in this topic.
The different way
you guys
had
the whole afternoon, we could spend.
different mines and the way they functioned. And some of them have safety devices in them. So after, I don't know, like 100 days or 120 days, basically explosive cutters would blow through the side. So that means that you could use an area again. It was like a safety device. But it didn't always function. You know, these things were made en masse in factories by, on the whole, young children and women, because all the men were fighting during the war. Russian mines particularly are quite dangerous because they look like they were made in a garden shed, probably, because they were. I mean, they to the point of they were armed from the moment they came out the factory, so it was quite dangerous transporting them.
Can you imagine the lorry full of mines?
Put them in the wagon, boys.
The German and the British mines, they had soluble plugs, so you plopped them in the water and 12 hours later they would arm themselves. But yeah, so that's what we were doing. We also found a torpedo as well, a few other things. But we also did stuff on land, so... we didn't actually end up doing the job, but we one of the towns near one of the harbor cities, they had found, it was in Germany, a construction site. They'd found a whole heap of ordnance because...
So that was probably our fault.
It was probably us that was, it was us that was bombing it.
Yep.
And it was actually the German dive team that went and dealt with that. But, we were doing all sorts of things. And then came back home. You do a lot of training, and the next deployment was out to the Middle East. So we went out there. It was 7.5 months out there. A huge range of stuff. It was basically, a lot of it was force protection, keeping shipping channels open, but we were also doing some stuff on land as well. And then we went out towards Somalia as well, and was doing some anti-piracy things out there, just as a force role, as part of an American task force. So most of the time in the Middle East, you're working with American units, which is pretty cool. After that deployment, came home, and then I was part of a bomb team based in Glasgow, so west coast of Scotland in Faslane, and our job was kind of to support the submarines around the world, because that's where the main submarine base is. That's where they keep all the nuclear weapons. And the other role was bomb disposal. So on that team, they've got IED and EOD on that team. So we covered, our range was huge. It was like all the way down. It was like part of the way down to England, the whole of Scotland, and part of Northern Ireland as well. Wow. So it was a huge range. And yeah, so that was an amazing time, because you got to drive around the country, blow things up on beaches, and hand grenades. We had one where a walker had found a hand grenade, and they walked into a police station and put it on the counter, and the police are like, "What the fuck?" and
that's exactly. Oh, I found it. Hey guys, look.
I don't know what this is. I don't know how it functions, but can you take it?
It had a pin in it, but I don't know
where
that
went. I
didn't
think you needed that anymore. Yeah,
it turned out it was some weird... I can't... Because we couldn't even ID it properly. We did eventually, but it was some Eastern European hand grenade that we hadn't even seen before. And you plonked that on the counter, and obviously the whole police station has to evacuate when you do that. And they're like, "Cheers." I mean, the normal...
Here's a small bomb.
The normal advice is, if you find a piece of ordnance, leave it where you found it, and then just call the police.
Yes.
And then they'll call whoever needs to be called.
If anything comes out of this podcast, folks, if you find a hand grenade, leave it be.
Yeah.
We were once in the same place at the same time. I was doing some hunting up in the Isle of Skye. And Daryl knew that I was up there, so it was when he was in this team. And he says, "Are you still in Skye?" He says, yeah, and no, I'm still here. I'm here with our buddy, Scott McKenzie, who's, interestingly, the last full-time gamekeeper and stalker on the island.
Oh, wow.
It used to be full of them, but it's the last managed estate. So I was doing some stalking with him, taking some pictures. And Daryl said, "Well, I'm on my way up right now. We've got the lights on. They've found something on the beach." And it just so happened that his boss was big into hunting. And because I wrote for one of the hunting magazines, he also had read my articles and that. So he said to Daryl, if he can be there, you should come down and we can have a look, and I can watch the team work and watch my brother work. And I said, well, you know, I'll try if we can. But we had an agenda. We were getting content stuff for the magazine. So then he messaged me back and says, the boss says that if you can make it, you can press the button to blow it up. I was like, okay, yeah, no, it's okay. I've rearranged the day.
My brother's awesome.
Yeah. Great. So I don't think it really was. I think it was just a piece of scrap metal, but they put a lot of explosives on it so that I could press the button. And it was a very, you know, you couldn't even see it where we pressed the button from, just to make sure that we weren't in the blast range. But you could feel it in your chest.
Yeah.
You pressed the button and it was like boom. And this vibration. So
yeah, it was pretty cool. We I'll tell you one more.
I was gonna say, any close calls along the way, because I am interested in the subject.
I had close calls diving.
Yeah.
On my it was a day before my 19th birthday. We're in the middle of the English Channel, and my captain said to me, this was my first piece of ordnance I'd done completely on my own, and he said to me, it's your birthday. Congratulations. Here's
happy birthday.
Yeah, we found something. So I went down, I did the first dive, I did all my measurements. So basically, how it works is that most of the time you're working in the dark, the North Sea is particularly bad for visibility. So you measure everything with your body parts. So that's a lot of your training is, you know, knowing your measurements, your thumbs, your arms, so on. And you've got to be within 10%. Basically, if you put all these measurements in, and the shapes and sizes of it into a computer, then it'll bring up what piece of ordnance is, and it'll tell you where the explosives is and basically the best place to place charges or anything you want to do to it. So I went down, did the recce on it, and ID'd it. It was a 500-pound German airdrop bomb, and it'd just been rolling around the seabed. And it was in a fairly busy shipping channel. I mean, the English Channel is probably one of the busiest
in the world.
And so we're like, oh, let's get rid of it. So a few hours later, it was probably about 3-4 in the morning now. And they're like, right, you can do it. It was 42 meters under the water. So I went down. And basically, because of the depth, I only had a certain amount of time before I could go into stops. And stops basically means that when I come up, I might have to wait at 10 meters for 10 minutes or 15 minutes and so on. And the idea is that if you're placing explosives on a piece of ordnance, you don't want to be doing any stops. Or you can do drifting stops where the boat kind of takes you away from the piece of ordnance. And I went down there, and I didn't make the explosive pack up. So basically, it's plastic explosives with deck cord going all the way to the surface onto a float. And the swell had picked up by the time we got out there. And basically, there was like a 2-meter kind of swell, and the person who I think I know who it is, but I'm not going to mention it. Hadn't taken into account the swell. So basically the deck cord was slightly too short. So I'm down there and I've got half a meter of between the bomb and where I can actually pull. And I'm like, how am I going to get this explosive pack underneath or like around this thing? Eventually, I kind of like anchor myself, like holding on to the bomb. And I managed to
pull. Two bombs. I got one bomb here.
I managed to pull it underneath. So like the pressure is pulling it up so that the float doesn't yank it. And I managed to tie it on. It took a bit longer than it should have taken, but I didn't go into any stops, and I came back up, and we blew up, and it all went fine. But about an hour later, I just started losing the vision in my eyes, like blurry, couldn't see within 30 centimeters of me.
And we had a phone call at home I don't know, somebody on his ship.
It was my XO that called, and I was like, oh shit. Like this is not good, and it was really cold as well. It was like -20 Celsius, and I mean it was so cold that we had like icicles off the side of the ship. I mean, it takes a lot to freeze seawater.
Yeah, salt water.
And we were lucky enough that the Germans that were with us, they had a diving nurse who specialized. We were all medics to help each other anyway. So I was sitting in the chamber, our dive chamber on our ship. And it had broken. The seal had broken on it. So we're like, our dive chamber's out. And so I was transferred to the German ship, and the German nurse is there, and they're doing, you know, all everything you can think of. And she's trying to put a bloody IV in me. and she missed four times in my arms. And I told her to fuck off because I was like, she said to me, "Do you want it in your foot?" And I was like, "You can no." I was like, "I can't see
body part."
Yeah,
of mine.
I was like, "Go away." I was like, "I don't need fluids." eventually, they had a Sea King helicopter come and pick me up. And take me to a place called Helgoland, which is an island off the west.
Sounds foreboding.
Yeah. Basically an island off of Germany. And they had a diving doctor on that island. And they took me there. And you got to fly really low level.
You're still no sight. You're not completely blind.
I'm not blind, but I can't see. Like, I couldn't, if I was holding my phone,
yeah,
the entire screen was blurred.
How long did this go on for?
It lasted 2 days.
It's quite a long time, eh?
I was thinking of 2 hours. 2 days. Unbelievable.
They flew me there, and the diving doctor was like, I have no idea what's wrong with them, because they started just ruling things out. They're like, we don't think it's the bends. And I didn't think it was either. I don't know what it was, but I just was like, there's something wrong with my vision, but I don't know what it is. Eventually, they made the decision not to put me in the chamber, and... this is the British military all over made the fantastic decision. I got no idea why they did this. They're like, you need to fly home now. Bear in mind, they had no idea what was wrong with me. So they dropped me off with a rib on the jetty in Germany with a piece of paper. Bear in mind, I couldn't see properly to the taxi driver. Yeah. Gave it to him. He took me to the airport, and then I had a note in German basically saying. on me to keep on me if I pass out, what's wrong with me on the plane, because there was a high chance that something might happen if I'm flying.
Because now he's going to altitude.
Yeah, now you're going to altitude. And you can't. But after 2 days, they kind of were, it's relatively safe. I arrived back to the UK, and my vision just started coming back. I got no idea why. I went to an eye specialist, and she was sitting with Google open. And I was
that's
like,
not a good sign.
No, you like, do you not think the German doctors googled it?
Yeah. Like, you have no idea what was wrong with me. Basically, the conclusion that they came to was actually a combination between the diving and the really cold temperatures basically made my the muscles and that in my eyes to. I'm not sure if it's muscles, but basically, you know, when your eyes focus and close like a camera, basically they just frozen, not frozen, but they just stop functioning for whatever reason.
Lagging like our LCD screens.
Yeah. But yeah, that was kind of the closest call
close
I had.
Enough. 2 days.
And it was pretty scary because I didn't really know what was wrong with me, but I had confidence that I was going to come out the other side. And I did. I went straight onto Christmas leave after that because it was actually the end of the deployment. That's what really annoyed me. It was like 3 days before the end of the deployment, I got sent home. And I had booked flights personally myself that I paid for because the dive team was allowed to go home slightly earlier because we were doing another job after. And they flew me home for free anyway. And my flights that I just booked, that I paid for, I couldn't use. And then I was diving like 3 weeks after that. And it was part of a crossover course of a new dive set. And after a week of it, someone comes and is like, "Diver Pace, we've got a thing here saying that you're not actually medically clear to dive." No one had told me this. And I'd been diving for a week. So then I had to go to the experimental diving medicine place, and they did loads of tests on me and just made sure that I was going to be okay. I never had a problem since.
Really?
Yeah, never had a problem since.
That's not common. That can't be common. I mean, the way you describe it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone had a clue, and to this day, I still don't know what happened, what went wrong. But I was fine afterwards. No ill effects. My eyes are sharp as anything. I'm just glad it's never happened since.
And all this time, your brother's running around as an outdoor writer.
Well, yeah.
No, you were doing some other things, I know.
Care, though.
Yeah, I know. Like, let me get this deer down, and then I'll deal with this.
Then I'll come home and make sure you can
see. Yeah, so during all this time, what were you doing?
So I did quite well at school, and one of the frustrating things that I've come to realize since then is that there's an expectation from most people. You go through high school, next step, university.
Yes.
I'm sure it's the same here. Especially here. If you've done kind of...
Same here, though.
I didn't do well enough at school to do that.
You could have gone to university, probably, if you'd really wanted
if
to. But it would have been a waste for you.
It would have been. And you know what really annoyed me is I joined the Navy because I was like, I hate exams. Honestly, I hated... I liked school. I was good at school, but I never did particularly well in any of my exams. Other than the ones I was really passionate about, like PE, because it was just physical exercise. Yeah. And history, I did really well in history. But I was like, I'm going to join the Navy, and then fuck exams. I did more exams than I have ever done in my entire life.
It's funny how, like, you know, my brother is a world-class artist. I can't draw a stick figure. Like, I'm a writer. He can't write his way out of any paragraph.
But he can draw like Picasso.
This is funny how those things.
It is strange, isn't it?
You know, whether that's nature or nurture, who knows? But you have a degree in economics.
Yes. Yeah, so I went the stupid things you think when you're 16. So yeah. I actually left school a year early because I had everything I needed. When I finished school, I was still 16, but I was 17 by the time I went to university. A lot of the universities, actually, they would have taken you, but they recommended, you know, you've got in, but wait until you've a year older.
Yeah.
A bit more
so
mature.
So you can drink.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's part of it because you can drink till you're 18. But I had this great plan that I was going to go and work in the city, be a fund manager or something like that, or stop broke and retire at 30.
Cool.
I'm 31, so I'm definitely not retired yet. So you can tell that plan never worked. But, you know, the motivation for that was because I wanted to do the things that I really wanted to do, which was the only thing that I did when I wasn't studying at school or swimming. Both of us, Daryl's missed out a massive part of his growing up, which was we did a lot of competitive swimming.
Yeah.
Which helped me in the water situation.
Yeah. So that took up a lot of our time when we were younger, was that I just wanted the time and money to be able to do the things that I wanted to do. So this was my grand plan. Yeah. Sacrifice 10 years of your life.
Don't we all have grand plans?
Yeah. Man up, tough it out, get in there, get the job done, get out. So I studied economics, which is the perfect thing to do if that's where you want to go. And I knew I went to study at the University of Stirling. And I actually got a sports scholarship for swimming for the first year. But I knew within about 6 months, like, this is really not interesting me that much. I'd rather go fishing.
Yeah.
my cousin, incidentally, who now lives in New Zealand, but he was my
good
sort
man.
Of fishing, hunting buddy growing up. He did a similar thing, and he went to study medicine, and he liked fishing so much that he failed 2 years of medicine. But he still became a very good
He's
doctor.
A doctor now.
And now he's moved to
a short delay.
The mecca of fishing. But, you know, parents are always encouraging you to, you know, stick in and kind of tough it out. So I did, and I was quite good at it. You know, I did well in the exams, and the sort of competitive nature in me is probably more than anything else what made me do well at it. Just a lot of study more than anything. But after 3 years, I just had enough. I was like, I want to be in the bush. I want to be in Africa.
Yeah.
Spent my whole childhood reading Capstick and hearing the stories, you know, from my dad, and then we visited all the time anyway to see my grandparents. But it wasn't until years later that I really saw Africa when I worked there myself. So I ended up somehow through summer gardening jobs, getting a role or being involved in a company that manufactured and designed tranquilizing darts for darting big game. And they were based literally 5 minutes from my parents' house.
Yeah.
So I started doing some stuff with them, and then the opportunity came as part of the sort of testing and development to go out to Africa and start darting elephants and rhino stuff.
In Kruger National Park.
That's right. You've done your research, Ben.
I'm just reading the thing while you're talking. I've done no research. When I read, I just was reading all that, you know, this morning about you guys, and I came across that, and I thought I knew we were going to talk about.
What was that in? Where did you read that?
It's on your website.
Oh,
That's an easy mark. It's not like I did any real fucking research. Clicked on the website.
So yeah, in Kruger Park,
Which is you know probably in my mind is stands up to Yellowstone Park because it's notoriety.
Most people will probably know Kruger if they had to name an African park.
Sure, they would know it. Kruger, yeah.
So they, all the stuff that we were doing there was, all the rhinos were dehorning or chipping for obviously rhino poaching. The stuff with the elephants was recollaring. So they actually, I didn't dart it, but I was there with the team and the helicopters and stuff. They darted this, at the time, the second biggest bull in Kruger Park. Interestingly, that day when we did that, they went up in the helicopters and they found the elephant, and they hadn't darted any elephant. This is what I was told. I haven't actually check that this was true, but I've no reason to doubt it. They hadn't actually darted any elephant on foot there for a very long time because it's quite dangerous.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Yeah, it's got to be out of a helicopter.
Normally it's out of a helicopter. But the whole point behind this new dart system was that you could dart at much longer ranges. You could, I mean, I shot it plenty. You could dart out almost 100 meters.
Yeah.
Very successfully. So this was kind of the point. Let's dart it on foot. So they found the elephant that they wanted to dart with the collar on it. They went in, they darted it. Took a little bit of time to find it after it went down. It took quite a lot of time and much longer than it should have taken to find it. And so they went up in the helicopter again, and then they found the elephant still standing. So they thought they'd missed it. So this time they darted it from the helicopter. And it turned out they darted two elephants. Oh. And there was another elephant there with another collar that they didn't know was in the area. So they ended up changing the collar that needed collared, that they needed changed, and then just checking out the other elephant and then, you know, giving them the revival stuff and they're being on their way.
Yeah, what are the mechanics of changing an elephant's collar?
It's, I mean, the box on it's like the size of your laptop, yeah. Like this deep.
Yeah.
And it's just a big, I don't know, I can't remember, a synthetic collar. But held on with bolts.
Yeah.
So it's just ratchets. You know, so it's like six bolts and you just ratchet it off and then ratchet it back on. And I guess there was a new battery pack in there so that they could keep tracking them. So that was definitely one of the coolest things I did when
you guys are way cooler than I thought.
Thanks.
Not that I didn't think you were cool, but like you dived into the English Channel and put out a bomb and you were darting elephants in Kruger. Well, I don't know what I was probably doing.
I forgot to mention.
Chasing chicks in a bar in Maryland.
I probably had the most expensive fishing boat on the planet because I was on a mine hunter. When they were hunting for mines, they travel at like almost nothing, but it's enough for a trawling speed. So I used to throw a line over the back of the ship. And just trawl for fish. And when I was out in the Middle East, I actually used to catch loads of fish off the back, and I used to trade them with a local guy for like ice creams and chocolates and DVDs, like pirated DVDs and all that kind of thing.
That's what I'm talking
about. Yeah, I used to trade them fish for doing that. But
what fish were you catching?
Oh, it ranged from some of them. I didn't even know what they were. I just knew that he would buy them.
Looks like this guy would like this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That looks edible.
but a mine hunter is the most expensive ship per square meter because it's made out of fiberglass, the entire ship.
Oh, yeah.
So it was the most expensive fishing boat, trawling off the back of it. And it doesn't have props either. So your line can go straight down almost, and you won't get caught in the props.
Wow.
So. Pretty nifty.
I got nothing. Got nothing.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate Batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
One time. So a lot of interesting subjects. We got to speed up because you got to go. But
that for me, the weird thing with that kind of initial experience was, as I said earlier, we'd been going back and forth to Africa for years. Cousins there, grandparents still live there. Obviously, my parents are from there. But I'd kind of always gone, even though they lived there. My grandpa fished and stuff a bit, and they did some cool stuff, quad bikes and jet skis and that. But they weren't hunting and they weren't fishing.
Yeah.
They weren't involved. We'd go to Kruger Park and you'd look around, but you were a tourist. And then I was there and I was like part of the team.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, now I can smell Africa. And it really got under my skin. I mean, it was under my skin anyway, but I was just completely screwed after that because I ended up going, so I had 2 years out of university during that period of time, and I went back to Africa in that sort of 2 years, and I spent a couple of months there. My grandparents very kindly kind of looked after me as I was bouncing around visiting different people, and then that was kind of my HQ. I'd go back to their house, so they were very kind to kind of put up with somebody who was a bit lost, trying to work out, you know, what the hell do I really want to do? But I made some awesome friends during that period, and a lot of my hunting buddies and PHs out there now are people I met during that period of time. I was, during most of that, I was writing for a hunting magazine back in the UK, Sporting Rifle, and a few other publications, and it became my kind of gateway and excuse to visit places. So I'd literally just arrived on the second trip, and I wrote about 30 emails to outfitters to say, you know, I write back in the UK, spend a lot of time in Africa. I'd love to, if you've got a hunt going on, I'd love to just join it. You know, I don't expect to do any hunting, but I'd love to just write about it, take some pictures, and then you can get some exposure back at home. And a handful of them got back to me, and I made some great friends that way. So
that's awesome.
That was pretty incredible. And I've gone back once or twice a year ever since. But after sort of 2 years out, so we needed to do 4 years to get your honors degree back at home, I kind of came to the realization that what I was doing with that, the company wasn't really going anywhere, and they've actually folded. They don't exist anymore. So even in hindsight, it was a shrewd move. And I think there was always this element of, it's probably fair to say, sort of disappointment from my parents that I didn't finish my degree properly. I had a bachelor's, but I mean, that doesn't really mean anything. Didn't finish my honors. And at that point, like, no one else in the Pace family had a degree. Like, I was the first to go to university in that line. So I didn't need to do much to finish it because I'd done quite well. So I just like, sod it. Let me just go back. So I went back, got my honors degree. And now I've got this honors, this first in economics. Like, what the hell do I do with
it? You're feeling pressured.
Feeling a little bit pressured. I mean, not that they put pressure on me, but you just feel it. Like, you know, people around you and like, what the hell you've been doing? Because I'd had a lot of fun for 2 years and I'd been trying to find myself, but I didn't have a career. I was doing some writing that would put a little bit of food in my mouth I was eating at my parents' table. I was using that to go hunting. Let's be honest.
As we all do.
But I applied for jobs that you would get with an economics degree, and I ended up getting a job with BlackRock, the largest investment company in the world. I think it still is. Certainly was at the time. But in 2008, so just when he's going to Navy, I get a job at the start of the financial crisis in finance. Brilliant. But I was a risk analyst, so that was the one thing everyone needed.
I was going to say,
no one knew what anything meant or what its worth was, so they needed risk analysts to work it out. So that's what I did, and I knew within like the first 5 days of that job that I hated it.
I was going to say, was there any exciting moments, or was it just like...
There was one highlight in that 2.5 or 3 years. So I started in Edinburgh, which was good for me. Edinburgh's a beautiful city. So
yeah,
if I had to live in a city, Edinburgh, I could probably stomach it, and I did for a couple of years. But basically on Friday, when I finished work, because we started at 6:30 in the morning and we could finish a bit earlier, though it very rarely happened. But on Friday, I always tried to finish a bit earlier. I got in my car and I drove straight home so that I could hunt all weekend. That was my routine every week. It was stupid of me because I didn't see much of Edinburgh, even though I lived there for 2.5 years. But the highlight of that Black Rock experience, it obviously taught me a lot of life lessons. But the highlight of it was I helped set up the fixed income side in India, because they were continually trying to cut costs. So that was why they moved our team from London to Edinburgh. And then eventually I set up the team that I had been part of in India.
Oh, wow.
For a couple of months. And my plan there was just to kind of work the Monday to Friday and then experience India for what it was. So I was taking trains up into the mountains and fishing the rivers there. There's no hunting, but just trying to immerse myself in the culture as much as I could. I actually took a train. This was kind of near the end of my trip. I wanted to go up to fish the Ganges River because I knew that there was golden marsier in there.
Yeah.
And I'd seen golden marsier in the Corbett River. Obviously, the famous writer and hunter Jim Corbett had been in his national park the weekend before that. And the only way to get there was basically to take a train. So I took this sleeper train, which is very, very different to the sleeper trains that we have at home, up hours and hours. It was like 6 or 7 hours. So I got on it in the evening, and I found my little space, which was, my bed wasn't much wider than your laptop, and it was sat on chains, and there was 3 on each side, and then seats, because that was like one of the premium carriages as well. So I didn't sleep at all because it's really noisy. It absolutely stinks. And I was also worried about, you know, people stealing my stuff. So sleeping on my rucksack.
Yeah.
But for some stupid reason, I'd never thought to think to myself, well, how am I going to know when I get off? Because if you get on a sleeper at home, you know when your stop is, and someone comes and chaps on your door. They even bring you a cup of tea.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I used to take the sleeper down to London when I worked there.
So it only costs about £5,000.
Yeah, I wasn't paying for it. I wasn't paying
tea.
For it on a London
one. Expensive tea.
Yeah. But obviously you don't have that on these trains. So I woke up as the train had slowed down, and I look out the window. And out the window, I can see the name of the place I'm supposed to get off, and the train's going. Oh, shit. And this train went right to the north of India. Like, next stop, friggin' China. So I was like, what the hell am I going to do? And there wasn't many stops. I'd only stopped like 3 times in 7 hours. So I ran to the door, and all the doors were open with my backpack on, and I'm looking just like at the railroad going past and all the bush, and in the distance I can see some lights. I said, I'm just going to have to wait. There's nothing I can do. I can't exactly jump off at this speed. And then it slowed down. Like 30 minutes later, it slowed down a bit but didn't quite stop. And I could still see lights in the distance, and I just sod it. I'm just going to jump off because I don't know what's going to happen. How am I going to get to where I need to go? So I jumped off the train, and it's like 4 o'clock in the morning in the dark. And then walked through the bush, like, I don't know, 30, 40 minutes to this little village. And eventually I managed to solicit a ride to the place I needed to go to. And then I camped and in a little hammock and walked down the river back to a place, fishing back to a place that I thought I could get a lift back to the train station. Long story short there, I ended up at a whitewater rafting camp by mistake. And the owner there, who was an Indian guy, thought I was completely mad to be walking out there by myself, because I saw leopard prints in the sand where I'd been camping. I think they were leopard. I don't think they'd been tiger, but they looked like leopard to me. And he just thought, it was like, what on earth are you doing, you little white boy? I don't understand. He just...
I'm a risk analyst.
Yeah, exactly.
What are you?
I'd calculated
that. Have you been analyzing anything lately?
I was living.
Yeah.
And so he gave me food and everything. I ate at his camp. And then I met this Indian couple there. It's weird how life works out. This who had just got engaged, and they were there with their friend. It was kind of a weird honeymoon because it was the couple, plus they had their buddy there. And they'd lost their camera. And they were so gutted that they'd lost their camera, and they had no photos from like the last week up there. And I obviously had a camera with me. And they were like, would you mind... obviously, because I looked out of place, they ended up speaking to me. It's like, would you mind taking pictures? Like, well, we're just messing around the beach for the next half an hour, and you know, send into them to us because we got nothing from our honeymoon. It's like, yeah, of course, no worries. And then they gave me a lift all the way back to New Delhi. So that was, but I left that because the moment there, I ended up going work back in Edinburgh, and I've told the story a few times, but I know that people have taken something from it. So I was sitting in Edinburgh at my desk looking at my 3 screens of graphs and analytics, just I was looking for any excuse out. I thought I was going to become a helicopter pilot. I was like, anything can must be better than this. And I was desperate to get out. But you still got to make a living.
Yeah, how old were you?
So I'm...
It's fairly young still then. Huh?
I'm 24 or yeah. 5
yep.
yeah, at the time. And we'd had a week where we'd had a lot of like big dogs over from New York and stuff. And we'd been out for a lot of dinners and I'd heard a lot of stories and... You know, if you and I were to go out for a beer and or any of the people that I've been with this week, it's like it's fascinating. You're yeah. talking about really interesting shit. Yeah. And I was just bored out of my mind all week. I'm eating in fancy restaurants and places I can't afford to eat.
And you're starving afterwards.
Yeah. You're starving afterwards. And I'm hearing all these insignificant stories about fast cars and lap dancing clubs. And it's just bullshit. You know, stuff that, okay, yeah, we all do it and yeah. you, we can appreciate that.
Two-dimensional conversations.
Yeah, but it like life is more than that. So yeah. I literally, at the end of that week, I wrote my resignation letter. I printed it off in the printer behind me and I gave it to my manager.
Well
and I said, look, I don't want to leave you guys stuck because it was you know, it was an important job. So tell me how long you need me for and then I'm afraid I'm out of here. And after that, I went back to Africa for a few months. And then kind of I paddled around for a bit, writing, started to do a little bit of film work.
Yeah.
And then again... I was looking for direction, but also knowing that I really needed to kind of get a serious job. I need to buy a house.
Yeah,
you know, I got to do something that's a bit more. So I ended up going and I started studying petroleum engineering, and I got a job in oil for 3 years as a drilling fluids engineer. But then the downturn came, and then that's kind of where our paths and lives crossed. So during this whole time, I've missed out all the hunting and fishing, but that was every spare minute that I had.
Yep.
I was reading, writing, or hunting or fishing. That's basically what I lived for. But our paths crossed at this point because Daryl had come out of the Navy and had done a year in Australia commercial diving and had come home and was trying to find a job.
Commercial diving and spear fishing.
Yeah, that's commercial diving
yeah, spear and fishing. Surfing. Yeah. Yeah.
That's surfing.
That's basically what I spent my year doing.
And were you married at that time?
No, not that time.
You got engaged out there.
I was engaged out there.
Yeah.
Not to an Australian. To my wife that's from Scotland, but she came out with me to Australia.
Yeah, she'd for a long time, hey?
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed my job in oil. It was a really good job, and I was good at it. But it's still not hunting or fishing. And the reason that I did it was, one, it was interesting, but two, I got 6 months off a year. So on rotation.
Yeah.
You work for 3 weeks, you're off for 3 weeks. What can I do in those 3 weeks? I can go hunting and fishing. But when the downturn came, that kind of all went to shit because loads of people lost their jobs. I didn't, fortunately. But it meant that they were always trying to make the best use of resources. So I was never at home. And I was not doing my job most of the time either. I was doing shit jobs like cleaning pits of just crap out of oil rigs and that because they were like, well,
yeah,
you should feel lucky that you've got a job now.
Yeah.
And I said to Daryl, for whatever reason, I still don't quite know exactly what the catalyst was. It's like, there is a gap in the market in the UK to make some hunting films that mean something. And I'd done a bit of filming before. He hadn't, but he'd always, you know, taken pictures and used a camera. And I said, what do you think? Let's try and start this. So we, at the same time, there was these Merlin groups were starting up in the UK, which was a collection of areas around Scotland initially that were designed to basically help portray in a positive manner how our uplands are managed.
Yeah.
And they needed to tell the story. Cue us just starting to make films. And our local group, which has been one of the most successful in their endeavors.
Due to our films.
Due to partly due to our films, but also because they've got an awesome coordinator who's now a very good friend of ours. We kind of got together and said, yeah, we can do that. We didn't know we could do it, but we said we could do it. And Daryl eventually left his laboring job that he was doing.
I couldn't get a job diving.
Yeah.
I came back from Australia and I was like, what have I just done? Because I had a really good job out there.
Yeah.
And I came back, I was like, I cannot find any work. And then I was just doing a laboring job. And yeah, it was soul destroying. So
this was a lot more fun.
These are the best stories. Like,
so we just started. And I kept working in
just
in
put oil all of our money in.
Yeah,
yeah.
I kept working in oil for a year just to kind of help support the start of the business. And after a year, I left. We had done a couple of films for the Merlin groups, but over that period of time, our kind of idea of showcasing what we could do, I believed we could do it. I didn't quite know how we would do it, But it's very difficult to go to a company and say, hey, do you want me to make your film? It's going to be awesome.
Never done it before.
Oh, yeah. Just show me something you've done before. Oh, no, I haven't actually done anything before, but I promise you it'll be awesome. Like, it's a very difficult buy-in.
Self-belief right here. That's worth a lot of money.
So fortunately, because I've been writing for so many years, I had a lot of good friends who were connected with different companies in the UK. And I managed to convince them that we could do it. And we were going to do a film, a short six-part series called Into the Wilderness, and it was just going to be us hunting the way we like to hunt, which is actually quite different to most of the hunting in the UK. It's much more like how you guys hunt.
Yeah.
But trying to tell a little bit of the culture and the story in it, well, that was kind of the original thought process. So we got some sponsorship in for it that kind of just paid enough to be able to afford to
do it.
That's
how all sponsorship begins. Yeah. Just
and enough. That was that kind of little portfolio was the catalyst for everything else that followed. And actually, we always thought we would carry on doing stuff like that because we like and we get to hunt a lot, even if we're filming ourselves. And we've basically done nothing like that since, because off the back of it, we've continually been asked by various people or companies to be involved in projects where we've been the people filming or producing or taking pictures, which I'm not complaining about, because
it's a lot different than being in front of the camera.
It's a lot different than being in front of the camera, and we've got to hunt in inverted commas some of the most awesome places on the planet. And to a certain extent, I don't care. Like, I've hunted a lot, and I don't need to be killing something every time. And I've shared the experience,
like the bison hunt.
Yeah,
I was on. I mean, I wasn't going to be pulling the trigger.
No, I could see it in your eyes when you're telling story. You know, the brief story about your bison hunt. Like, your eyes were lit up just to be there. I think that's something a lot of hunters could learn from. I've seen it a lot in our industry, and I've been that way some parts of my career. It's like, you just want to hunt. You don't really, like, you're not thinking about the end result. You just want to go out there,
live it,
and
breathe
hunt
it, smell it,
find it. Like, wherever it is, you're going to find it. And if you have a job where there's like maybe a hunt, you'll do anything to get out there and go hunt it. Yeah.
The best stories, the thing that I was so gutted by when I was back at BlackRock was that the stories were shit that all these people were telling. It's like, these are not interesting stories. Like, Daryl's just told you a heap of interesting stories out of the Navy.
You both have.
And he's only scratched the surface.
Yeah.
It's like, give me a whiskey, I'll tell you a lot more.
I got plans.
I cannot live my life and be an old man and have those stories.
Yeah, I mean,
if that's my life, what is the point?
I mean, like I say, I always say this, there's the two-dimensional life and the three-dimensional life. Like, a two-dimensional life are the stories you're talking about. Like, I have this. This is what I have. Yeah, but what is it giving you, really? And what's it giving the people around you? Like, you've been to Nepal. You could freaking, you know, you could share.
Yeah.
Like,
and now, through experiences, you have shared connections. Yeah. So, like, when you were on our podcast the first time, I started off asking you about Nepal because there was this weird connection there because we've been in the same place at a slightly different time, and it brings people together.
Yeah, there's something about that. You know, I'm sure you guys wouldn't say this, but I feel like when I look over to your part of the world or anywhere close to where you guys are, you're the most prolific photographers, filmmakers, podcasters. I mean, it is the breadth and depth of work you've been willing to, that you've put out over the last years is amazing. I mean, it really is.
Appreciate you saying that, Ben.
And you've spun these, like, you know, you guys are smart dudes with passion for it, and you found it because you had to.
I don't think it was a choice.
Yeah,
I think there's something there.
Like, you just, like you said, you're always looking for it, even if you get lost in a career choice or, you know, some destination you think you have to head towards, you're still looking.
The podcast was an interesting one because we started that just because we felt there was a lack of education in the UK, and we just wanted
an open platform
could access for free.
And how long have you been doing the podcast?
Three and a bit years.
Yeah, 3.5 years now.
Yeah. So 3 years, and how many podcasts do you feel like are hunting, fishing related in
there's
Scotland?
Three, I think.
Three.
That's it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, so one only started 6 months ago, another one was probably a year ago.
Yeah, it's not that regular, actually.
It's not that regular. So yeah, we were the first in the UK.
Yeah. I mean, and what's the, you know, there's obviously the American influence, right? I mean, we talk about that all the time around, like, how much the American culture and our value systems and our model of conservation has affected other hunting cultures around the globe. But, like, what do people where you're from say about what you're doing? You know, are they
about what we do?
Yeah, are they inspired by it? Do they pick up a rifle and go afield because of what you're doing?
That's, like, the beautiful thing.
Yeah,
and a combination of the film, but probably more importantly, the podcast.
I wouldn't say it was people who were inspired by us.
No, actually, not by us.
It's more the guests. The podcast is probably the biggest thing that really gets people thinking. And we've had more emails and messages from people saying, I'm getting my certificates for rifles. I'm doing my first hunt because of the back of this, that they've listened to on the podcast, or they've emailed going, now I get it.
Yeah.
There's something I didn't know before. I had a misconception about something. Now I get it.
Well, yeah, maybe I don't fully agree with you, but I understand more. And that, you know, sometimes you can wonder, especially with the podcast and what our intention for it was, is whether if you're really making a difference. Because we can talk all day to hunters and it's good fun.
Yeah.
But is that really going to make a difference to the understanding of what we do in the greater the world? No. You know, we need to reach out.
Yeah.
And this is it's a free medium. It's hopefully easily consumable. And I'm sure you have a lot of people listening to your podcast who have found it somehow, who it's maybe not a big part of their life, we are not saying that everybody needs to hunt, but it's good that people can at least understand it from a different point of view.
Yeah.
That's been incredible. Every time I get an email like that, where I hear from somebody who is not inside the general hunting community, who has taken something from a conversation with one of the awesome guests that we've had on, it just makes me smile.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have a good contingent of people that don't hunt on our podcast. And a part of that is just due to some of the guests. Some of our guests are just they're not hunters in any way, but they're adventurers, explorers, just doing really cool shit.
Yeah.
It's all about good stories.
Yeah, that's
good
it.
Good stories and living life as it should be, which means whatever you're doing, you need to find meaning and you need to enjoy what you're doing. Yeah. And anyone who enjoys what they're doing in life is going to be a cool person and have awesome stories.
Yeah.
And it's about sharing that.
Yeah. I mean, who are your I guess this can be cliche, but who are your like outdoor heroes? Who are the people that, drove you to that, if you have them?
For adventure?
Yeah.
Or just
somebody you read, somebody who's like shared ideas, like clicked in you that, we tell stories all the time around here about, books and writings and people that there's something inside of you that you can't explain, and then someone explains hunting or explains fishing in a way that you're like, that's it.
There was two things. One, watching Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman go around the world on a motorbike. When I saw that, it blew my mind when I watched them first do that and the adventure they had going around. I was like, I want to do something like that. And the second one was Ed Stafford. He was the first man to walk the full length of the Amazon. We were lucky enough to actually just have him on our podcast, which is really cool because he's like a hero of mine. And then he comes on our show. And I saw him talk as well a few years ago. And he's just a phenomenal, inspirational person. And the trips and the expedition he does solo are absolutely incredible. So if I was... Yeah, go and buy his book. I think it's just called Walking the Amazon. It's also a DVD.
Yeah.
The film's good.
Well worth going to see.
For me, it's probably a little bit more cliche for the on the hunting fishing side. When I was younger, on the fishing, it was a very famous English fisherman and naturalist called Hugh Foulkes. I don't know if you've ever come by him.
I'm not familiar, but I will.
Beautiful book. The book on sea trout in particular. I used to read that book when my mom was driving us to the swimming pool to go swimming training every night. I mean, it's a big, thick book like this, and I consumed it multiple times. So he was probably my first sort of hero of the countryside. It would have been Hugh Foulkes. Because it turns out later, as I found out more about him, that he was a complete womanizer and a bit of an asshole. He was a fantastic...
Never meet your heroes.
But he was I never met him, but it was just what I heard. So it might not have been true, but he was an amazing naturalist. The detail with which he studied what he was passionate about was incredible.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, I mean, the usual suspects for being intrigued about Africa and then North America. The one that is, there's two books that have impacted me most in recent times. One is Aldo Leopold's book, Sand County Almanac. And it's in that bag sitting there. And the second one was a book which I literally have only read in the last 6 months. And it was sent to us by a podcast listener completely out of the blue with just a letter in it by Grey Owl. And it's one of the name of the actual book, he didn't write that many, has slipped my mind at the moment. And he is, you know, one of the great conservationists for the Canadian wilderness.
Yeah.
And that book just was unbelievable. The section about, I gave it to my dad when it arrived, and he was sitting in his office. He's just retired, but he had an office next to ours. And I gave it to him. I said, you know, I can believe this podcast listener just sent us a first edition book about Grey Owl with a handwritten note saying, I heard you mention this film about Grey Owl, and this book made a big impact on my life. So when I saw it in the bookshop, I just bought it. That's why I want you to share it with you guys, which was incredible.
Our listeners are awesome.
Yeah, they are. And I gave it to my dad, and I went back in like 45 minutes later, and he's always busy, and so he was reading the book. I said, you've been reading the book the whole time? He says, I can't take my eyes off it. And it was like that for me. So when I remember Pilgrims of the Wild, that's what it's called. Grey Owl, Pilgrims of the Wild, that book is unbelievable. And if you can't appreciate nature after reading that book, then there's no hope.
Yeah, you're hopeless. Yeah. What do you guys, what's on the horizon for what for your adventures?
We're off to Africa.
We are. We're off to Africa in April. We've got some clients going out, and we're going to be making some films. We're doing some filming with pangolin. Hmm. So we've just started an auction to raise some money for some pangolin research. And we're hopefully working with a company that was approached us again through the podcast, funny enough, to try and get some software together for tracking pangolin. Wow. With a guy over there in South Africa who we've got to know.
If you don't know what a pangolin is, it's like an armadillo-looking creature, I guess,
yeah.
Which is the most trafficked mammal on the planet.
Yeah. Really?
Yep.
I didn't know that. I knew what a pangolin was. I was just thinking, I bet people listening to this don't know what that is. I didn't know it was the most trafficked animal on the planet.
It is. The most trafficked. And they've
just found a big consignment of it recently.
They're endangered. These guys are poached for their scales, which have zero medical benefit. Same as your nails that are on your hands, and people are, convinced. Grinding them up so they can get a big hard on, and that's basically what it is. It's for Viagra and all different.
Well, it's not for Viagra. No, it's like
voodoo medicines that don't work, and we're working with the guys in Africa because there's actually species of pangolin in Asia as well. And, I don't know how they're going to tackle that because obviously it's quite hard with governments there. And that's where most pangolins are going anyway. So it would be quite hard to any kind of rescue effort over there. But in Africa, there's still hope and there's people on the ground doing some really cool stuff. And
so that, awesome. I mean, in our immediate future, that's what we're doing next. We're going to make a film about it. And the calendar will undoubtedly book up. Yeah. I'm off to Namibia in...
Nice.
May for that's a conference for the Council of International Conservation.
Awesome.
To talk about basically the future of conservation and hunting. So that's going to be interesting as well.
Probably be off to Norway at some point. We keep going back to Norway. I was there in October, November last year.
Working.
Photographing a moose hunt. Wow.
That's a whole story in itself.
What an incredible experience.
That's the place in the world that I most want to go.
Oh, you got to do it, man.
Sweden or Norway. Yeah, either way.
Blow you away.
This is like hunting moose in the mountain, and it is your legs are just killing you by the end of a few days. But you're walking so many miles each day, and it's such a cool community thing they have over there, where there'll be 10 of you that kind of go out in the morning and you're spotting in the mountain range. And these are steep, steep mountains. And you see a moose and then you'll go out and you'll walk 15 miles kind of across these things, and they'll shoot a moose out right at the back of where probably a glacier would have been. And once it's shot, the one that we did shoot on kind of the last day, it's all cut up, hung up in a tree because it was late in the day. And then the following day, we hiked down the mountain, went back up again.
The whole community
kind of walked. Kids. So there was like 10, 11 people. We were up there by 7 in the morning, and there was people already with backpacks walking back down. And when they come back down, they finish the job in a garage, and then it's shared out between all of the people that were hunting and in that community, all of the meat.
Yeah. I might start a commune just like that.
That's very cool.
People think I'm weird, but... like that's great. What I people that a lot here in the States talk about solo hunting and celebrate going out in the wilderness by yourself. I do enjoy that, but nowhere near as much as I enjoy like being in a camp with a bunch of people.
It's great.
And being surrounded by a bunch of people. Like the
campfire stories.
Campfire stories, man. Campfire stories. Well,
we're going to get our ass kicked by an ex-Navy SEAL in a minute. If we don't leave and go to the next meeting.
You guys better go. Yeah. This dude, he will kick your ass.
And the guy's a mountain tough.
I've met him a few times, but I don't know him well.
I've just heard
the rumors that Mountain Tough Fitness is like...
Well, we've got a workout at 12.
Well.
And we've been traveling for the last 2 weeks.
If we're late... That workout's going to be even worse, even more painful.
I feel bad. Let's close the podcast by you telling everybody we figured out earlier what your porn names were. What was it? It's your first pet.
Yeah.
Is the first name. And your last name is, you didn't have a street where you grew up, but the town where you grew up.
Yeah. So it would be Bimbo Inch Bear
We both had the same pet, but my first actual pet that was mine was a dog called Sparky. the close to Inch Bear where I went to school is Edsel. So it'd be Sparky Edsel.
Sparky Edsel and Bimbo Inch Bear. You almost got through the podcast without having, I almost forgot, you brought up the boner scales,
and
the boner scales, and my mind was like, I had to make sure I mentioned.
And
that.
I dragged down the podcast.
I ruined the ending. All right, boys, thanks for coming. I appreciate what you do.
It's great to speak to you again.
I need to come to your neck of the
woods.
There
is an open invite for you in Scotland and the Highlands. So,
all right,
make that journey.
Convince Ranella to let me out of Montana.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, boys.
Cheers.
That's it. That is all. Number 50 in the books. Pretty cool. Pretty cool discussion with those two boys. It was early in the morning. Snow was falling in Montana. But it was an interesting conversation, and it's good to know a little bit about their backgrounds and what they do. I'd love to have them back or go visit them in Scotland and learn a little bit more about wildlife management and things and land use over there in their part of the world. But we just had an interesting conversation. We got rolling and didn't get to it. But we'll get to it next time. Hope you enjoyed this one. Either way, I love those guys. What else? Well, a lot of things going on. But number one, we're still rocking and rolling on the Meat Eater Live Tour. You've heard me say it before, I would imagine, if you're listening to this, that it's going. So if you go to themeateater.com, you go over there, what you're going to find is the events page. Click on that, find the event near you, and then go. We just announced the Austin podcast. I believe it's on April 2nd in Austin. Come see us, man. I'll be there. I'll be on stage. I hope to see all you Texans out there cheering us on, talking hunting and fishing. Regular business, subscribe to our newsletter. Go to the website to do that. Go to the website, look at our store, see if you find anything in there you'd like to wear. Or stickers you might want to put on your truck or vehicle or Prius. Who knows? I like Priuses are fine with me. I'm fine with it. But all those things you can do here with our folks at themeateater.com. But I would say in closing for episode number 50, it is exciting to be a part of this company. I am running around every day from meeting to meeting, discussing concepts for content, new content around people you know, some people you don't, ideas that I've never considered. It is invigorating and inspiring to be around these people, and I cannot wait for you all to hear, to read, to watch what we're producing here right now in the future. I think it's going to be an exciting years for us, and I know some of the concepts we're discussing and pitching and batting around here and even producing already are stellar. And it's a pleasure to be a part of this crew that includes Ryan Callahan, Giannis Patelis, Steve Ranella, Morgan Mason, Spencer Newharth, Sam Lundgren, Miles Nolte, all the guys I'm working with. It is an amazing team, and I am very excited for all of you to hear and watch and listen to our content going forward. So I'll get off my soapbox in regards to that, but it's been a good time here in Bozeman lately. And so that's all I have for this episode. Join us next Tuesday for some more talking, and hopefully the next time you'll join us as well here on the Hunting Collective. Bye-bye.
You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.